The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Croner from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. If you have any questions or would like to become a sponsor, please contact our office at 919-832-5138. Okay, let's start off with a little humor from the Reader's Digest. Your mom said, "What?" Does your mother have a habit of saying things she shouldn't? Then you will surely enjoy our fond and funny collection of mamapropisms. And there's a picture, a cartoon picture, of a young lady with her mother, obviously her mother behind her, and there's a sign up there that says that there's a position available, and it looks like her pants are on fire. I confided that I was discreetly looking into other teaching positions while still employed by my current school district. Mom warned me, "Now don't go burning your britches behind you." Helen Ray Wise, San Ysidro, California. We were new to the neighborhood, so my parents invited a few couples over to play bridge. Pleasantries were exchanged, families were discussed, backgrounds compared. "You're from New England, my stepfather," a proud Connecticut Yankee declared when he detected a tail-fell accent from one of the men. "Yes," the man said, "but I bet you can't guess where my wife is from." The woman in question smiled broadly, but before she could speak to offer a snippet of her own regional locution, my mother piped up with the answer. "She must be from Scotland, because the Scots have terrible teeth." Indeed, the woman was from Scotland, though the truth did not set my stepdad free from his embarrassment. My mother has always had a tendency to blurt out information that other people would keep to themselves. It's not that she's mean, far from it. It's just that, like a blender without a lid, she doesn't have the proper tool for keep her thoughts from spraying all over the room. Alas, this is something of a hereditary trait in our family. Her mother also provided unsister insights to people. When I turned 16, she generously offered to pay for me to get my nose fixed. Thanks anyway, Grandma. People always laugh when I tell them stories about my family's silver tongues, but they invariably have their own tales. So we at Reader's Digest decided to collect readers' favorite stories. Some of them are accidental zingers, like my mom's. Others are language mix-ups that produce a sort of sweet word salad. Think of them all as a tribute to helpful moms everywhere, a verbal Mother's Day gift. We even gave them a name, Mamapropisms, after the imitable literary character Mrs. Malaprop. Come to think of it, she was probably a mother, too. Twisted sandwich wisdom. My mother would always say, "Mind your PBJs," when she meant to say, "Mind your P's and Q's." Kathy Schuller, Port Lucy, Florida. Not dressed for success. I always sat in the front row during rehearsals of the church choir. But when it was time for our big performance, I was sent to the back row. Dejected, I relayed my woes to my mom. She said, "Honey, it wasn't because you can't sing. It's because you don't know how to sit in a dress." Somehow that made me feel better. And Christina Holt, Plainfield, Indiana. My, how you've changed. One day, my mother ran into a woman who said they had gone to high school together. Mom insisted she didn't remember her, so the woman came to our house with her yearbook. She pointed out her photo and then my mother's. "Well, of course I didn't recognize you," Mom said. "You were pretty back then." Debbie Hackison, Anchorport, Alaska. Messy runs in the family. Sometimes my mother would surprise us by visiting our house on Sundays after Mass. I was a busy mom with my own business and six children still at home. Housework was not at the top of my to-do list. One Sunday, my adult son, Dan, was also visiting. When Mom marked that she hadn't yet seen his apartment, he told her to let him know when he would like to see it and she could clean. So he could clean. "I'd be embarrassed to have you just drop by," Dan said. "It can't be a real mess." "Worse than this?" she blurted. Mary Potter Kenyon, Dubuque, Iowa. Wait, she really is a good girl. My preteen daughter and I were shopping. I called her over to where I was, and she responded with the same thing she always said whenever I needed her for something. "Just a sec." I don't ever think before I called back. "No more sex for you, young lady. Get over here right now." Big oops as soon as it left my mouth, and I noticed that people had turned around to stare at us. Bonnie Skinner, Dryersburg, Tennessee. White coat syndrome. Unless she's near death, as she put it, my mom refuses to go to the doctor. Recently she noticed her doctor at a church reception. The man nodded and smiled at her, and she walked over to join him at the dessert table. "I really need to call you for a visit," she confided. "I know it's been a while." He nodded knowingly, and she leaned closer to whisper into his ear. "You know I would come and see you more often if you wouldn't ask me to take off my clothes every time." A red flush kept up the man's neck, and he shook his head and smiled. "I believe you must have me confused with someone else," he said. "Perhaps your doctor?" "Jan Sybil McKinney, Paris, Texas." That would be embarrassing. "When my brother, my sister, and I were little kids, we could run around outdoors. My mom would say, 'If you fall down and break your legs, don't come running to me.'" Kathy Millicks, Newton, New Jersey. "Stop the presses. My husband had just opened a printing business. He called it Alpha Thermography because he specialized in thermography, a type of raised print. One day I overheard my mom telling one of her friends, 'It's called Alpha Pronography.'" Janice Seidner, Nashville, Tennessee. Disaster proof. Mother was a champion worrier. It didn't matter how much my siblings and I tried to reassure her. "Worrying work," she liked to say. "Look at all the things I've worried about that never happened." Elaine Hester, Hearst, Texas. What is it about Texas? There's a lot of them in here. First National Bank of Mom. My mom spoke very little English. When I was going through my rebellious teenage years, I would often taunt her with the retort, "Leave me alone." One day I overheard her commiserating with a friend. "All my daughter ever says to me is, 'Give me a loan, give me a loan.'" Chris Caraban, Highland Mills, New York. What will the neighbors say? When my mother did her laundry on a sunny day, she liked to hang her wash on a clothesline in the backyard. I was on the phone with her when an unexpected shower popped up, and she said to me, "I have to go. It's starting to rain. I have to go outside and take off all my clothes." Sandra Young, Bethel Park, Pennsylvania. The last maritime signal. Why do Norwegians put barcodes on their battleships? So when they dock, they can Scandinavium. They can Scandinavium in. That's terrible. That's a bad thing. Okay, we've had the humorous. Let's do some rather more serious stuff. The classic. The medic gets his answer. A surgeon who saved the life of a shattered, blinded soldier long wondered, "Did I do the wrong thing?" 2 decades later, the two meet again, and the doctor learns the life-changing truth. And there's a picture of a bunch of medical first aid kit here, surgical instruments, etc. In the late afternoon of September 21, 1968, the crew of an Army UE helicopter with the call sign Ghost Rider 281 began a perilous descent into jungle terrain to assist a shopper shot down by the North Vietnamese. Leaning out of Ghost Rider 281 as far as possible, 19-year-old door gunner Kenneth McGarity was helping direct the pilot when an enemy rocket struck the UE. McGarity took the brunt of the explosion. The pilot was able to crash land. McGarity was picked up and flown to the Army's 71st Evacuation Hospital. "Oh, God, I hurt so bad," McGarity cried over and over as he was brought in on a stretcher. The young soldier was covered in mud and with one leg hanging by more than a strip of skin, and the other mangled almost as badly. His arms were broken, his finger was missing, and he was bleeding over his left eye. The surgeon on call, Dr. Kenneth Swan, 33, had arrived in Vietnam only a month before. "I couldn't believe the man was still alive," Dr. Swan later wrote. "I didn't want him to be alive." Still, the surgeon and him told him what he must do. Fortunately, Dr. Swan had the time and the resources to give the wounded soldier his full attention that night. He was the only serious new casualty brought in. Dr. Swan directed the surgical team and amputated one of the soldier's fingers and both legs from the thigh down. A neurosurgeon cut through the skull to see massive head injuries caused when a metal fragment pierced McCarthy's left eye and entered his brain. As a urologist worked on extended wounds in the groin area, two orthopedic surgeons set both arms in plaster. An ophthalmologist was unable to save either eye. The operation took 8 hours. The next day, Dr. Swan's medical supervisor pulled him aside and told him the other surgeons had questioned the wisdom of saving a man who would have so little to live for. Dr. Swan's action had been a horrible mistake, they said. Maybe I did the wrong thing, he thought, when he learned weeks later that the badly maimed soldier had survived and been flown back to the States. He was again plagued by self-doubt. What kind of a life have I created for this man? He wondered. A living hell? And there's a picture of Dr. Kenneth Swan in his uniform. He had been in Vietnam only for a month when he worked on the injured soldier. Back home, McGarity underwent additional eye and arm surgeries and further amputation to his legs. In such excruciating pain that he was on round-the-clock shots of morphine, he eventually became addicted. Visits from his parents and friends hurt just as much as they soothed. Though he couldn't see, McGarity sensed their discomfort. It was clear that his former life was gone forever. Then 6 months into his convalescence, McGarity reached a turning point. One night, a soldier who had lost a leg asked him jokingly whether he'd go and fetch them something to eat. McCarthy had so little strength that he could barely sit up. He couldn't see to navigate his wheelchair to the hallways, let alone find the military hospital's PX. But by feeling his way along, by asking people for directions, he somehow managed. And after he got back to the ward with a bag full of candy bars and crackers, Kenneth McGarity realized that there was hope. He finally said to himself, "I'm going to make it." During the next 6 months, he underwent intensive rehabilitation and kicked the morphine addiction. Gradually, he learned to feed himself alone, shave, get dressed, and bathe without assistance. In October 1969, 13 months after he'd been injured, he checked out of the hospital determined to rebuild his life. McGarity settled in Phoenix City, Alabama, where his parents lived. He was financially secure with veterans benefits. His all-consuming interest was a new CB radio, and in July 1971, he was introduced at Seabeer's Picnic to a young woman with a sweet voice. Her name was Teresa Leverett. Teresa, 19, had finished her first year of college. Although she was shy, she had no trouble opening up to this charming veteran with the easy laugh. She didn't give his disability a lot of thought. Teresa's grandmother had been blind, and a friend with cerebral palsy was in a wheelchair. Soon she and McGarity fell in love, and by November they were married. Doctors told the newlyweds that because of McGarity's injuries, they most likely would never have children. But just 2 years later, they were overjoyed to learn that Teresa was expecting. Alicia was born in 1973, followed by Elizabeth in 1980. "If there were times in my life when I wished I had eyes again," McGarity said, "it was there in the delivery room, holding those newborn babes in my arms." There were harsher realities, too. Though McGarity had done a remarkable job of overcoming his physical handicaps, Vietnam had taken a devastating toll on his psyche. Every time a jet flew overhead, he would dive to the floor in panic. In the autumn, he would experience severe depression that lasted for weeks. He endured terrifying nightmares, flashbacks, and mood swings. The fallout was felt by the whole family. "A day never went by that I didn't discuss Vietnam," Teresa says. At times, he wondered whether they would ever put the war behind them. Dr. Kenneth Swan, who went on to become a professor of surgery at the University of Medicine and Dentistry in New Jersey, thought of McGarity often, immediately after the war. But over the years, he managed to repress the memory of the soldier he'd rescued from death. Then one day in 1988, Peter McPherson, a journalist, asked him, "Did you ever make mistakes?" The question brought it all back. When Dr. Swan tried once to discuss McGarity at a medical symposium and got choked up, he knew he could no longer ignore the soldier's fate. "I didn't think I'd like what I'd find," he says. In fact, he felt there was a good chance that McGarity had died. But he had to know. "I had to face up to what I had avoided for 20 years. I had to find out if my decisions had been right one, and if it wasn't, what it had cost McGarity. I had to learn the truth." Locating McGarity seemed impossible. However, Dr. Swan remembered many details about the soldier, but not his last name. With more than 300,000 wounded Vietnam veterans listed in the Pentagon's archives, tracking down one soldier without knowing his surname proved an awesome task. It took 2 years of searching before Dr. Swan and McPherson, with the help of the military, located McGarity. In April 1991, the military wrote to McGarity about Dr. Swan's request. Teresa read the letter to her husband, who was thrilled. "I knew there was a doctor somewhere who had saved my life," he says. "I always wished I could meet and thank him." Dr. Swan was astounded when he heard about his patient. "I was told he's married, has 2 children, enjoys scuba diving, and has taken college classes," he recalls. "I said, 'You've got the wrong man. My patient has no legs, no eyes, badly damaged arms, and a head trauma.' The Army insisted that it had the right person." Dr. Swan and McGarity spoke several times by phone before deciding to meet. Then in December 1991, 23 years and 4 days after the battle that nearly took McGarity's life, doctor and patient reunited at McCarty's home in Columbus, Georgia. During the five-hour visit, Dr. Swan talked about that night in Vietnam and his doubts about saving McGarity. "Even in my darkest moment of pain," McGarity told him, "there was never a time I wanted to die." McGarity peppered the doctor with questions, hoping to fill in the holes in his memory. "I needed to find out the facts. I wanted to know how close to death I was." The details seemed to help McGarity get beyond his past. The flashbacks and nightmares declined dramatically. Teresa had hoped for that for years. Dr. Swan was also moved. He called the meeting the most dramatic event in my career. He was astonished to learn that McCarthy played piano and trumpet, did indeed scuba dive, and had completed a year of college. The doctor refused, though, to take much credit for the way things turned out. "The older you get," he says, "the more you realize that those little doctors contribute to a patient's outcome. The miracles of modern medicine usually are not man-made. Doctors are 5% God, and the patients are the rest." On January 30, 1992, Kenneth McGarity was awarded the Medal for Heroism that, because of a mix-up, he had never received. In an emotional ceremony at Fort Benning, Georgia, before 30 relatives and friends and Dr. Swan, McGarity was presented with a Purple Heart, an Air Medal, and four other awards. It was fitting tribute to a man who spent every day of the 23 years since his injury, overcome adversity and courage with courage and valor. However, McGarity does not consider his achievement exceptional. "It was my job. I volunteered to do it. I believed in my country then, and I believe in my country now." Private McGarity and Dr. Swan continue to be in touch via Christmas cards and notes. When McGarity died in 2007, Dr. Swan sent flowers to the funeral. Dr. Swan died in 2014, and his wife Betsy said that he forever cherished meeting McGarity after the war. She shared a story her husband had written about his experience, in which he said in part, "What I had said that morning after Ken's surgery was true. I was trained to care for the sick and the wounded, and God will decide who lives or dies. But the day of our reunion, I knew it was true in the depth of my being. God can work miracles in the most desolate circumstances for those who, like Ken McGarity, have courage in birth." Reader's Digest goes to war. Soldier Stories revisits triumphs, tears, and occasional humor from a century of American battlefields. There's 23 stories covering every major conflict from World War I to the War on Terror, after a keen reunion of our military's timeless inspiration. Soldier Stories are available at rdstore.com and wherever books are sold, if anyone is interested. The Genius Section. Sharpen your mind. Zing. How to craft a comeback. And there's a picture of the guy who played on Friends. I can't remember his name. "Winston, are you drunk?" And Winston Churchill replies, "My dear, you are ugly. But tomorrow I shall be sober and you will still be ugly." In 1997 episode of Seinfeld, the comeback, George Costanza is merely stuffing himself with free shrimp at a meeting. His co-worker mocks him. "Hey, George, the ocean called. They're running out of shrimp." George sits there humiliated as laughter fills the room, his mind searching technically for the perfect riposte. It's only later, in the drive home, that he thinks of his comeback, but the moment has passed. That may be in the good thing until George's epiphany was predictable, mediocre. "Well, the jerk store called me and they're running out of you." The disappointing experience of thinking of the perfect response. Too late. L'espire de fescalier, or staircase wit, was identified by the French philosopher Denis Diderot. He was so overwhelmed by an argument at a party that he could think clearly again only once he'd gotten at the bottom of the stairs. We've all been there, envying those who are quicker on their feet, so we decide to ask people who rely on witty rejoinders for a living, improv moment performers, freestyle rappers, and others, how anyone might seize the opportunity for a clever retort in everyday life. Here are their insights. Don't think too much. In improv, the funniest responses occur on the spur of the moment, says Douglas Wittig, a performer who trained with Chicago's Upright Citizens Brigade. Don't worry about crafting the perfect reply. It's about letting go of the need to judge ourselves, says Belinda Raffi, CEO of Berlin-based company Maflick, which uses improv skills in business, especially if we are operating from the desire to make each other look good. a key tenet of improvisation. Not every riposte will be a gem, but some will hit their mark. Listen before you leap. Still, spend some time considering the argument that your sparring partner is laying out. Your retort may be more accurate and therefore more successful, says Jim Tussone, a business technological expert turned improv coach who developed the Improv Means Business program. Put a few in the bank. Some of history's most skilled comeback artists stored witticisms for later use and were able to pull them out into memory at a critical time. Winston Churchill was known for his comebacks, but Tim Riley, director and chief curator at the National Churchill Museum in Full Moon, Missouri, says that many of his burns were borrowed. One of his most famous lines was in response to a jab from politician Bessie Braddock. "Winston, you are drunk," the prime minister replied. "Bessie, my dear, you are ugly, but tomorrow I shall be sober and you will still be ugly." Riley says a line similar to the above was actually copied from a W.C. Fields movie, which likely lifted from a dig made by a House of Commons member. Nevertheless, it took quick thinking to pull it out at the right moment. It was an off-the-cuff recall of something he had synthesized, composed earlier, and he was waiting to perform, Riley says. Don't obsess over a misfire. The high you get from spearing your opponent with a verbal thrust can be shadowed by its opposite, the low that comes from blurting out a lame response. If it doesn't go your way, the rapper LL Spoken advises brushing off your missed opportunity rather than dwelling on your error. It can be toxic to hold on to it, he says, and delays can be fatal. When you're conversing via text or social media, you get a few extra minutes to think through your responses. That could improve the quality of your remark, but don't deliberate too long. Replies lose their punch after a day or so. Speed is integral to wit, whether in real life or screen life, says Scott Thiessen, a social media expert at American University. In fact, some companies have learned to deploy quick-witted social media retorts as a marketing strategy. Wendy's Twitter account has become so well-known for its sassy replies that some users try to intentionally provoke it, almost like a battle of the wits. "Bet you won't follow me to Wendy's," a user challenged. "You won that bet," Wendy's immediately shot back. George Costanza also learned that he who hesitates often loses in the comeback game. He meets his shrimp nemesis again at a business meeting and takes the opportunity to use his old "the jerk store called and they're running out of you" line. Too late. The guy already has a comeback for the comeback. "What's the difference?" he asked with a smile. "You're their all-time bestseller." Check out these legendary comebacks. Abraham Lincoln. After being called two-faced about slavery by debate opponent Stephen Douglas, "If I had another face, do you think I would wear this one?" Reporter. "How many people work at the Vatican?" Pope John XXIII. "About half." Writer Lewis Morris complaining that his new book of poems hadn't been reviewed by the press. "That's a conspiracy of silence, Oscar Wilde, my dear Morris. Join it yourself." In 1954, poet Edith Stilwell was given the title Dame Commander of the Order of the British Empire. On a visit to the United States, an American asked, "Why do you call yourself Dame?" "I don't," Stilwell responded. "The Queen does." After a bout of drinking, humorist Robert Benchley found himself face-to-face with the uniformed man. Benchley asked the man to call him a cab. The man informed Benchley he was an admiral in the U.S. Navy. "Then get me a battleship, then," Benchley replied. A young unknown musician complained bitterly to composer Johannes Brahms about delays in the publication of his first opus. Brahms counseled him to be patient. "You can afford not to be immortal for a few more weeks," Brahms told him. In 1845, James K. Polk named James Buchanan Secretary of State. Former President Andrew Jackson protested. "But you yourself appointed him minister to Russia in your first term," says Polk defensively. "Yes, I did," said Jackson. "It was as far as I could send him out of my sight and where he could do the least harm. I would have sent him to the North Pole if we had kept a minister there." Okay, let's do a little word power just for fun. Long words may be tricky to pronounce, but they're a great way to impress friends or a date. This month's entries have at least 5 syllables. If they prove incomprehensible, turn to page 130 for the answers, and I have the answers. The first word is contemporary. Is that mean fleeting, thoughtful, or modern? Contemporary means modern. Joel prefers contemporary art over paintings by the old masters. Insurrectionist. Is that a mechanic, a nomad, or a rebel? An insurrectionist is a rebel. The insurrectionist overthrew the corrupt government. Extracurricular. Is that athletically inclined, left over, or outside the usual course? It actually means outside the usual course. Chor has a variety of extracurricular interests, including Russian literature and spelunking. Conniviality. A sleight of hand, merriment, or complexity? It is merriment. The village tavern is a piece of conniviality where neighbors enjoy one another's company. How about transmogrifer? Okay, this is a mouthful. Transmogrification. Hypnotism, change in form, or sea crossing? Actually, it's how to explain the princess. It's change in form. How do you explain the prince's transmogrification into a beast? That must be from Beauty and the Beast. Okay, now here's a mouthful. Triskaidekaphobia. The dread of magicians. Hatred of cats. Fear of the number 13. And that is fear of the number 13. Many hotels go from 412 to 14. A nod to guests with Triskaidekaphobia. Boy, that's a mouthful. Disingenuous. Is that out of order, insincere, or silent? Disingenuous is insincere. My sister's disingenuous apology for ruining my mother, my sweater, didn't make me feel any better. Verisimilitude. Is that a large crowd, a quality of seeming real, or a dizzy spell? It's a quality of seeming real. Archaeologists say the Flintstone has little historical vermicilitude. Impenetrable. Is that anxious, impolite, impossible to enter, or afflicted by the moon? Vermicitude is a quality of impenetrable is impossible to enter. The tech department's working to make our server impenetrable to hackers. How about superannuated? Is that prorated, outdated, or distorted? Superannuated is outdated. I can't teach science with these superannuated textbooks, as Dr. Sanchez complained. Heterogeneous. Is that masculine? About clergy or diverse? Heterogeneous is diverse. Home to millions of species, the Amazon rain is one of the Earth's most heterogeneous places. Pharmacology. Is that science of drugs, farming technique, or study of insects? Pharmacology is a science of drugs. Pharmacology experts haven't tested the new drug effectiveness on children. Paraphernalia. Is that an assorted gear, cranium, or cross-stitch? Paraphernalia is assorted gear. We need balloons, candles, and other party paraphernalia for the birthday bash. Phantasmagoria. Dreamlike scene, belief in ghost, or a mime show. It's a dreamlike scene. I am the walrus is a phantasmagorial sound and imagery. Idiosyncrasy, quirk, perfect timing, or greed. Idiosyncrasy is a quirk. Don't be boring. Embrace your idiosyncrasies. And with that, let's switch over to Consumer Reports. Road Report. Can we save more lives? Advances in safety technology are reshaping the auto industry. So why is the highway death toll so stubbornly high? And there's a picture of a huge interstate with cars everywhere, with some of them with anti-skid devices, some of them with radar all around the sides. And one is the explanation is vehicle-to-vehicle, everything communication. Cars and traffic signals will talk to each other to smooth traffic and avoid collisions. And another one is self-driving cars. Smart vehicles will use sensors and software to safely drive and navigate for you. And number three is a redesigned road. Some cities are reducing speed limits on roads with the goal of eliminating vehicle-related deaths. Of course, that also assumes that people will actually obey the speed limits. Automotive technology seems to be advancing at a breakneck speed. Today's automatic emergency braking, AEB, systems use sensors to help vehicles avoid collisions or reduce the severity when drivers fail to act. There are early signs that advances in vehicle V2V communications will one day allow cars to talk to and to avoid each other. And automakers and tech companies say that someday, self-driving cars, the holy grail of highway safety, may reduce or even eliminate crashes. Yet even with all the safety advances over several decades, more than 37,000 people died on U.S. roadways in 2017, according to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, down slightly from 2016. That's still about 5,000 more deaths annually than in 2011, a historically significant low point for fatalities. The National Safety Council, which also tallies deaths on private roads, says the annual figure is actually more than 40,000. Automakers and regulators have worked to make cars and driving safer for more than 50 years. So why aren't U.S. highway fatalities going down? People are driving more miles than in the past, but that doesn't explain the increase entirely. Transportation experts say the industry and others, such as government, road designs, safety regulators, and drivers, could be doing more to bring the number down. There is still as much safety tech on the shelf, and too many people are overconfident about their driving, says David Fremont, vice president of advocacy at Consumer Reports. The fundamental cultural question is, why do we tolerate this many highway fatalities? There isn't one answer. Drunker drivers are still killing themselves and others, and distracted driving remains a deadly epidemic. Some argue that urban road design favors more traffic flow over safety. Many of the planned safety and advances from automakers are years away, and some proven safety features are still reserved as luxury options. CR believes that the systems with AEB, pedestrian detection, forward collision warning, and blind spot warning should come standard on all models because they save lives. For this report, CR looked at the stubborn problem of U.S. highway fatalities through the eyes of safety researchers. We analyzed what it would take to save lives with better cars, better roads, and better drivers. The numbers shouldn't be stagnating. They should be going down, says Jason Levine, executive director of the Center for Auto Safety. People, because we are human beings, make mistakes. We need to find mechanisms and technology to help people be safer. A bad decision by a driver or a programmer shouldn't cost a life, he says. The promise of self-driving cars is so exciting because the technology could significantly reduce traffic deaths. More than 9 of every 10 serious crashes are linked to driver error, according to the NHTSA. In theory, a robot-driven car doesn't fall asleep or get drunk. It doesn't make human mistakes. Of course, there are a lot of unknowns with this reasoning. Fully automated vehicles don't exist yet, and if and when they're launched for everyday use, they would still be vulnerable to other kinds of errors, such as design defects or programming glitches. And there's currently no agreement among regulators, automakers, and watchdog groups about how to measure the performance of self-driving cars on the road. Until that question is answered in a way that inspires public confidence, many of the expected safety benefits could remain theoretical. In the same vein, a V2V communication is often cited as a key to developing a future transportation system, so smart that crashes and traffic fatalities are rare. This technology uses short-range radio signals for the 5G networks of the future, so cars can talk to each other and coordinate with traffic signals. A few automakers have installed V2V hardware in vehicles, but the holdup is equipping more cars has more to do with the priorities than the pace of the technological development. A proposal by NHTSA to establish V2V ground rules has been mired in a dispute between automakers and tech companies. The tech industry wants the airwaves now reserved for V2V to be used to expand Wi-Fi, and there are other proposals within the government that are part of the debate. It's clear that some existing crash avoidance technologies are saving lives today. Some groups want more new cars and have these features, such as FCW and AEB. We can save countless lives by taking action now on verified technology and comprehensive laws, said Kathy Chase, president of Advocates for Highway and Auto Safety, a watchdog group in Washington, D.C., in a recent webcast presentation. The National Transportation Safety Board, the agency that investigates aviation accidents and other high-profile transportation crashes, has called for manufacturers to equip vehicles with some of these features. In 2011, it asked the NHTSA to develop regulations that require FCW and adaptive cruise control. The NTSB also has called for AEB in every car. The safety board can't create regulations on its own and usually only issues recommended after an investigation. Legislators and auto companies aren't required to follow them. In 2016, auto manufacturers came to a voluntary agreement to roll out standard AEB on almost every new passenger vehicle by September 2022. Even as many drivers wait to get these systems, just 44% of 2019 models have FCW and AEB as standard equipment. Rob Malloy, the director of highway safety at the NTSB, considers the AEB role an example of slow government progress. The fact that they're moving forward now, great. It just took too long. Malloy said that the auto industry tends to focus on the next big thing, and so incremental advances take longer than they should, costing lives. CR and other safety advocates say that the federal government should reconfigure crash tests to better reflect real-world dangers. The auto industry supports continued efforts to improve crashworthiness and overall vehicle safety, says Wade Irwin Newton, a spokesman for the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers. But he says customers could benefit from technology faster if compliance were voluntary rather than mandated through a typically lengthy rulemaking process. Anti-lock brakes, electronic stability control, and lane departure warning are examples of life-saving technologies that automakers introduced on their own, Newton points out. Automakers compete with one another to produce the safest vehicles, he says. Consumer Reports rewards automakers with make life-saving advances standard on all models. The most recent safety features that CR now factors into a vehicle's overall score include PCW and AEB. All vehicles need these proven technologies, says Jake Fisher, the senior director of auto testing. It's really a no-brainer, so we're rewarding companies that have added these systems. Part 2. The roads. Poorly designed road can escalate a small error into a fatality. Traffic engineers know that a minor change in the sweep of a curve or an unclear road sign can have an impact on safety. For this reason, dozens of cities in the U.S. are completely rethinking road design with safety top of the mind. In the U.S., there are about 12 roadway deaths per 100,000 people, according to the World Health Organization. In much of Western Europe, it's under 5. In Sweden, it's less than 3. Some communities are changing their street design and traffic laws. In 2014, New York was one of the first cities in the U.S. to adopt the Vision Zero concept, which calls for city planners to rethink everything about roads, bike lanes, and pedestrian routes. The goal is to eliminate all vehicle-related deaths. We want a safe system, says Leah Shellayum, executive director of the Vision Zero Network, a nonprofit organization that connects these efforts in cities across the country. Building on what has worked in other countries, Vision Zero pushes proven methods based on big data analysis to identify and improve dangerous streets and intersections. For example, in Seattle, officials reduced the number of traffic lanes on Rainier Avenue. There have been no serious injuries or deaths on that dangerous stretch since the change, officials say. New York City officials met the safety improvements to Queens Boulevard, which was transformed into a more pedestrian-friendly road with protected bike lanes and trees. Before the changes, more than 7 pedestrians were killed or severely injured per mile on the road. There were no fatalities in the 2 years after the redesign began in 2015. Projects like these often encounter resistance from residents who worry about longer commutes, and sometimes Vision Zero goals conflict with other priorities in urban areas. For example, some cities have found that lowering the speed limits requires changing state law. We generally know what works, Shalom says. We're just not necessarily doing it. Speed limits also play a key role in road safety. Yet outside of cities, the trend has been to set them higher. During the 1970s energy crisis, the U.S. adopted a nationwide 55-mile-per-hour limit. Signs reminded motorists that the lower speed saved lives. In the decades since, states have been allowed to set their own limits, and they've gathered and they've ratcheted upward. Most states have a speed limit of 65 or 70 miles per hour on highways. Seven states have adopted an 80-mile-an-hour speed limit on some highways. It's 85 miles per hour on a 40-mile stretch of Texas tollway between Austin and San Antonio. A California lawmaker recently proposed a West Coast Autobahn with no speed limit. Motorists have become used to driving faster than the posted speed limit, no matter the number, says Russ Martin, Director of Policy and Government Relations on the Governor's Highway Safety Association. Even though almost everyone recognizes that speeding isn't safe, they do it anyway. The public is generally not behind us, he says. It's no mystery that driver mistakes, It's no mystery that driver mistakes contribute to the highway crashes and injuries. Drunken driving, speeding, and failing to wear a seatbelt are three major reasons. Sometimes drivers engage in more than one of these risky behaviors than one of them at the same time. Each contributes to about 10,000 traffic deaths per year. Human behavior remains the most common contributor to crashes, but it's also the hardest to change. Men may be especially vulnerable. They're 1.5 times more likely than women to die in a crash, according to CR analysis of NHTSA data. Ken Kolosh, manager of statistics for the National Safety Council, says we persist in accepting the status quo because we see it as normal. We need to change our expectation, he says, not break out of our complacency. I'm sorry, I'm having trouble with my tongue today. Safety advocates say that solutions are well known. Seatbelt use, for example, is higher in states with strong enforcement. States with tougher drunken driving laws have lower death rates. Most states have driver texting, but the law doesn't capture other ways people use their phones. The NTSB has called for a ban on the use of handheld devices while driving. The fight to lower the death toll largely plays out in state capitals, and the political will needed to enact proven solutions isn't always there. We expect perfection, and we have so many fail-safes in pretty much every other transportation mode other than motor vehicles, says Jane Terry, Senior Director of Government Affairs at the National Safety Council. Why don't we expect the same and have some of those fail-safes in the roadway transportation system? Some progress has been made. Mothers Against Drunk Driving and other groups have succeeded in focusing attention on dangerous behavior behind the wheel. In 1998, the federal government lowered its definition of impaired driving to a blood alcohol level of 0.08 and established a grant program to encourage states to follow suit. The NTSB and other safety advocates say the limit should be 0.05, the same as in many European countries. Research shows that even having just a few drinks can impair a driver. Utah recently became the first state to lower its standard to 0.05. Restaurants and bars are among the groups that oppose lowering the standard. They argue that limited police resources will be wasted targeting light and moderate drinkers. Distractions by smartphones, including calls and texting, while driving remains a safety concern. The NTSB recently called for a national campaign against distracted driving as one of its most wanted improvements in save lives. NHTSA estimates that there are 3,450 fatalities involving distracted drivers in 2016. NTSB officials say they counted distracted operators in all modes of transportation, including truck drivers, railroad engineers, and boat captains. Many drivers think they can multitask while operating a car safely, but NTSB research shows that it's a myth. Humans can focus cognitive function on only one thing at a time, says Bruce Landberg, vice chairman of NTSB. We try to fix human nature here, but it's really hard. As safety advocates push for new laws, their energy is sometimes spent fighting the repeal of existing statutes, says Carly Claus of Advocates for Highway Auto Safety. Those opposed to such laws often argue that it's not the government's role to tell motorists how to behave. But in reality, there's a huge economic cost to traffic crashes. $242 billion each year, according to NHTSA. That amounts to an annual crash tax of $784 for every U.S. resident, Chase says. The cost includes property damage, subsidized medical services, and economic loss out of work employees. Chase says that toughening safety standards is a long process. Sometimes there's a very vocal, albeit minority, constituency that opposes some of these safety positions, he says. Sometimes there are lawmakers blocking them. There are multi-year efforts, Chase says. They take a lot of fortitude. And then I've got some inserts to this article that are kind of interesting. The anatomy of the modern seatbelt. And there's a picture of a young lady sitting in the in a car seat with her seatbelt fastened. There are some indications of the different items that are talked about here. Seatbelts have been around for so long, they sometimes don't get their due when people consider important advances in car safety. In fact, they are one of the most effective pieces of safety equipment in your car. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration estimates that seatbelts have saved more than 300,000 lives since 1960 and 15,000 in 2016, the most recent year which data is available. That compares with about 2,700 for airbags in 2016. Seatbelts have evolved over the last seven decades from a basic strap to today's highly engineered mechanism that do more than most passengers realize. Pretensioners. These devices on all driver and front passenger seats since 2008 have a mechanism that tightens the belt across a passenger's waist and or chest in a crash. Upon impact, sensors, which these use in airbags, bigger mechanisms that clamp down and take up belt slack. The occupant is held in place to reduce the risk that the body will come into contact with something in a crash. Pretensioners also ensure that occupants are in the safety position during airbag deployment. Inflatable seatbelts. Ford introduced the inflatable seatbelt in rear seats of 2011, Explorer SUV. It's a cross between a traditional seatbelt and an airbag. In a crash, the belt inflates like a long balloon-shaped airbag across the chest, increasing the contact surface area between the belt and the body more than five times. The bag stays inflated for several seconds. The technology may protect occupants better in certain crashes, such as rollovers. Load limiters. These are designed to reduce the potential for injury from a too tight seatbelt during a crash. The load limiter allows the seatbelt to spool out a little bit at a time of controlled way, reducing the force of the belt, applies to the passenger's chest. Volvo introduced load limiters in 1995. Their use is now widespread. What's the history of seatbelts? 1885, the first known patent is given to Edward J. Claghorn. Early belts were designed mostly to keep people from falling out of cars. 1956, Consumer Reports finds that many cross-lap seatbelts fail basic safety and durability tests. 1968, the new National Highway Safety Bureau requires passenger cars to have lap belts for each seat. Shoulder belts are required at front seats if crash tests prove they're necessary. Consumer Reports was a vocal supporter of making this a mandatory. 1972. The federal government requires shoulder belts for the two front seats that are closest to the doors of a passenger cars. Also, NHTSA strengthens the standard for a crash test, requiring seat belts to stay intact in a 30-mile-per-hour frontal crash. 1973. Because too few passengers are using separated shoulder belts and lap belts, integrated belts, where the lap and shoulder belts come together as one piece, are required in the outboard front seats of passenger cars. 1989. Seat belts next to the rear doors are required to have three-point lap shoulder belts. And in 2005, rear seats, including the middle, must have these three-point lap shoulder belts in cars and light trucks. And then crash test dummy of the future. That's kind of interesting. And there's a picture of one here. It looks really sophisticated. Meet Thor, the next generation dummy, perhaps coming to a crash test near you. The name stands for Test Device for Human Occupant Restraint. And Thor is packed with sensors and designed to act more like a human being in a crash than previous dummies. Thor will be used in European crash tests for the first time in 2020. The plan by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration to deploy Thor in the U.S. has been delayed. Number one, it points to the head. Better crash test dummy with more sensors will help automakers predict more accurately how people might be killed or injured in crashes. They will use the test results to make safer cars, ones that reduce the risk of concussion or even fatal head injuries. And then it shows the arms. The updated dummy has stimulated muscles and bones that bend and twist, making it move more like a human body than its predecessor, the Hybrid 3. Number four, pointing to the legs. Even Thor's knees, thighs, and hips have instruments that can protect it more accurately the effect of a crash on limits. And number three, Thor's abdomen has sensors that can help predict injuries to the internal organs. And bringing up the rear. The neglected back seat is the need of a safety makeover. Over several decades, crash tests and tougher regulations have focused on improving front seat safety, making back seats passenger safety. Not so much. For years, automakers have delegated design safety systems so their vehicles pass specific crash tests that are focused on the front seat, where most people ride and most injuries and fatalities occur. Automakers want to grab top scores on those tests conducted by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, an insurance industry-funded group. As a result, safety benefits have skewed in favor of the front seat passengers. But an average of 1,799 rear seat passengers died per year in crashes from 2009 through 2016, or about 12.5% of the total. That compares with an average of 19,846 per year for front seat drivers and passengers. Perhaps it's time to turn attention to the rear seats because similar safety strides, said Jennifer Stockberger, Director of Operations at CR's Test Auto Center. Prodded by demand, federal mandates, and the insurance industry, automakers have introduced life-saving innovations, including better seat belts, improved interior padding, laminated windshields, and airbags throughout the cabin. According to a 2012 NHTSA estimate, 613,501 lives have been saved because of safety advances. The number is even higher today. When auto safety regulations started in earnest in the 1960s, the front seat was the logical place to focus. In older cars, those occupants could be hurt a lot in different ways. Impaled by the steering wheel, injured when their head hit the hard interior surfaces, or ejected through the windshield. Now those with Uber and Lyft, and ride-sharing in general, move more passengers sitting in the back, forcing experts to rethink some safety priorities. Some basic technologies aren't usually found in the rear, such as airbags, seatbelt pretensioners, load limiters, and head and restraints, large enough to help adults, says Stockberger. American motorists also might be underestimating the need to wear belts in the back seat. A 2017 study of taxi riders in Las Vegas and San Francisco found that only about one quarter buckled up. Wade Newton, a spokesman for the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers in Washington, D.C., the industry's largest trade group, says some automakers are working on boosting backseat safety. He says at least two companies offer inflatable shoulder belts, and others are developing pretensioners, load limiters, and even airbags that activate from a lap belt. Well, we're almost out of time, so let's look at some Ask Our Experts questions. I love the idea of an electric car, but are there options outside of a Tesla or the Chevy Bolt? Tesla might be the brand most associated with electric vehicles, and CR recommends the affordable Chevrolet Bolt for its long range, 250 miles, and quiet interior. But there are other choices that you may or may not have heard much about, and even more EVs are on the way. At the high end, ranging from $44,000 to $85,000, new models focus on luxury, sporty driving, and quick acceleration. We're testing the new Jaguar I-Pace. Go to cr.org/iPace to read about our first drive and hope to have an Audi e-tron on our track soon. The BMW i3 is updated for 2019, and more upcoming models including the Porsche Taycan and Mercedes, the Porsche Taycan and Mercedes-Benz EQC. There are more affordable choices too. Nissan is releasing a longer-range version of the Leaf called the Leaf Plus, which Nissan says should be able to get 226 miles on a single charge. And the new Hyundai Kona EV, we're testing one now, Kia Nova EV, and Kia Soul EV all promise ranges longer than 230 miles. They're expected to offer versions under $40,000 before any incentives. You may also want to consider plug-in hybrids, like the Toyota Prius Prime. These can run on battery power for a short distance, but still have a gas engine for longer trips. They are good choices if you're anxious about running out of juice in an EV. Is there a way to tell whether my produce is really organic? Yes, if a packaged item carries the Department of Agriculture organic seal, it must meet the USDA standards. Among other things, these require that crops be grown without most synthetic pesticides or fertilizers or genetically engineered seed. Farms must be certified by a USDA accredited certifier and included annual inspections to make sure they are complying with the standards, says Charlotte Valley, MS, CR Senior Food and Nutrition Policy Analyst. But you often won't see a USDA seal on loose, unpackaged produce, such as apples. In that case, look for a sticker or band that has a price lookup, PLU. Code. Conventional produce, PLUs, have 4 digits and organics have 5. And the first number will always be a 9 if the produce is organic. For example, apricots, PLU, is 3422 for conventional and 93422 for organic. Note that genetically engineered produce used to have plus that started with an 8, but that isn't true anymore. PLUs no longer indicate this. Although PLUs aren't mandatory for regulated for government, these numbers are widely used around the globe for pricing and inventory control, so they're generally reliable and good for astute shoppers to know. And with that, we really have just about run out of time for today's broadcast of the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. We would like to thank all of our past sponsors for their generous contributions to the Reading Service. If you have any comments or questions or would like to be a sponsor, please call us at 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. So long until next time, and thanks so much for listening.